Well, our text this morning will be 2 Samuel chapter 11 as we continue our study in the life of David. Appropriate text for us to consider during the Lenten season. Well, it's quite common for a movie producer to come out with a sequel, right? After all, if you make a lot of money on the first one, then you retool it and people want to know the rest of the story. They want to come back to find out more about the storyline. Certainly that happens in novels as well. Of course, in recent years, it has become increasingly common to produce a story and then bring a prequel, right? I'm the Star Wars generation, you know, so they come out with the first three, and then they come out with the prequel. How did Darth Vader get the way he was? You know, well, let me tell you, for just a few dollars, I'll tell you how he came to be that way. The Hobbit, certainly not the way Tolkien wrote it, and yet the producers chose to produce the latter portion of the story, and then come back with a prequel. And so there's something there, too, that attracts us, isn't it? That's intriguing, and we want to know how the story came to be. We want to know the backstory. How did things get to this point? Well, David's sin with Bathsheba is well known. In many ways, David points us to Christ, not by means of comparison, but by means of contrast, doesn't he? That here we see overtly now, after looking at so many commendable aspects of David's life, we see that David was a sinner, just like the rest of us. Even the great, godly King David, who was a man after God's own heart, a sweeping statement about his life. But he too was a sinner. And we realize, certainly the Jewish people realize, that he was not the king whose kingdom would last forever. The king that the prophets had spoken of. And so they still looked ahead, and we know that king, that one who would come in the line of David, was the Messiah, Jesus, the high king. And so what we see and we long for in this kingdom of peace that was established under David, it makes us long for something even better, doesn't it? For a kingdom that will last forever, a kingdom in which evil will be vanquished. And there will be no enemies and no suffering and no crying and no death. This certainly, of all passages, makes us long for Christ. So 2 Samuel chapter 11, let's consider this text this morning. In the spring of the year, the time when, what did I say, 2 Kings? 2 Samuel. I think I got that wrong. 2 Samuel chapter 11. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. It happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful. And David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, "Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" So David sent messengers and took her. And she came to him and he lay with her. Now she had been purifying herself from her uncleanness. Then she returned to her house, and the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, "I am pregnant." So David sent word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab was doing, and how the people were doing, and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." And Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, and did not go down to his house. When they told David Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, "Have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house?" Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah dwell in booths, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing." Then David said to Uriah, "Remain here today also, and tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next, and David invited him, and he ate in his presence and drank, so that he made him drunk. And in the evening he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of his lord, but he did not go down to his house. In the morning David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In the letter he wrote, "Set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting, and then draw back from him that he may be struck down and die." And as Joab was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew there were valiant men. And the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell. Uriah the Hittite also died. Then Joab sent and told David all the news about the fighting, and he instructed the messenger, "When you have finished telling all the news about the fighting to the king, then if the king's anger rises, and if he says to you, 'Why did you go so near the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal? Did not a woman cast an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebez? Why did you go so near the wall?' Then you shall say, 'Your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also.'" So the messenger went and came and told David and all that Joab had sent him to tell. The messenger said to David, "The men gained an advantage over us and came out against us in the field, but we drove them back to the entrance of the gate. When the archers shot at your servants from the wall, some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also." David said to the messenger, "Thus shall you say to Joab, 'Do not let this matter displease you, for the sword devours now one and now another. Strengthen your attack against the city and overthrow it, and encourage him.'" When the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she lamented over her husband. And when the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. So here we have the account of David's adultery with Bathsheba. We have the subsequent circumstances surrounding her pregnancy, which complicated the matter for David, which threatened to bring it to light, his sin, that is. And then we have David's deceitful attempts to cover it all up. He brings Uriah back from the battlefront and tries to encourage him to go home and wash his feet, take a bath, get cleaned up, get refreshed, hoping that he'll go home, make love to his wife, and that he will assume that the baby was his. And of course, Uriah is a man of integrity. He doesn't do this. David even sent him with a gift. We're not told what the gift was. We can maybe use our creative imagination. Maybe it was a couple bottles of wine. It was something that would facilitate a romantic evening. But Uriah, based on conviction, based on the fact that all of his fellow soldiers are out fighting in the fields, risking their lives, Uriah is unwilling to go home and enjoy the comforts of his home. And so David then plots to try to get him drunk. If Uriah won't do this knowingly in his right mind, perhaps a good portion of alcohol will help sort of dull his senses and his inhibitions. And certainly then he will go home. And of course that doesn't happen either. And so David then resorts to cold-blooded, calculated murder. Not only of Uriah, but of a number of other innocent soldiers as well, who ended up dying in David's effort to cover up his sin. And the text would lead us to think, or almost think, that David got away with it, right? The loose ends are sort of tied up, and then we have this very succinct statement at the close of the account that the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. Interesting to me that the text says very little about some of the other main characters in the story. We're not really told much about Bathsheba, what she was thinking, her response. Did she resist? Did she oppose? Was she flattered? We don't have no indication. What about Uriah, or Joab rather, the military commander, who was basically asked to murder an innocent man? Did he question why? Did he offer a word of opposition to David? Did he resist in his heart? Nothing. Fact is that David sinned. Sometimes we can be that way, can't we? We can look at our sin and say, yeah, but if that person did not respond that way, I never would have done what I did. You strip all that away and you're just left with you and me and in our sin. Right? The text does that. Doesn't matter what anybody else did. David sinned. The thing that he did displeased the Lord. Now, God is a loving God. God is a merciful God, willing to forgive when there is humility and repentance. But God is not a permissive God. He's not a coddling parent. He's not naive. He's not a God who can be played. The silence of God does not indicate the absence of God. He sees what we think and what might be secret from others is well known to him. And he will not simply overlook or dismiss willful sin. The shadow of judgment hangs over this text. And of course, in the weeks to come, we'll consider the many consequences that flowed out of this series of decisions. But needless to say, the text should motivate us to flee from sin. It should cause us to examine our own lives and ask God to help us and to protect us. It should cause us to evaluate ourselves and to look at the smaller choices that we make and where they're leading us. The Proverbs say, consider the paths of your feet. Consider where your path is taking you. Texts like this certainly should sober us. So we could look at a lot of different aspects of David's sin here. Today we're going to give particular consideration to what I'm going to call the prequel of sin. And that's particularly instructive for us, isn't it? We want to know how David ended up in this situation, not just out of curiosity's sake, but we would like to understand how sin works. We'd like to understand the steps that come before sin so that we don't go down that path, right? I hope that would be our desire today, that we would want to understand the prequel of sin. And I would suggest to you that that God wants us to know the prequel of sin. He's quite overt about this. We could look at a number of passages. James 1, verses 14 and 15. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. A person doesn't just simply destroy their life in sin out of the blue, right? There's a series of smaller choices that have led them to that point. So James says, when we are tempted by our evil desires, this isn't wrong, it's just temptation, right? But when that evil desire, that selfishness or that inordinate desire or that tendency towards bitterness, I feel this sense of anger welling up in me at this person, whatever it might be, is that period of temptation and evil desire, wrong desire, but when that desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. Right? When that desire is gratified, when I respond to it, when I give way to it, now sin has been conceived. So certainly James 1 speaks to the prequel of sin, what leads us there. 2 Corinthians 2, verses 10 and 11. Anyone whom you forgive, I also forgive. Indeed, what I have forgiven, if I have forgiven anything, has been for your sake in the presence of Christ, so that we would not be outwitted by Satan, for we are not ignorant of his designs. So here Paul's writing to the church in Corinth, and there were many hard things that he had to say to them. The church had responded well, for the most part, to Paul's confrontation. And Paul says, I'm maintaining a discipline to extend forgiveness. And notice what he says there at the end. So that we would not be outwitted by Satan, for we are not ignorant of his designs. Paul understood that Satan uses unresolved anger and bitterness as a pretext for sin, right? Now, Paul understood that. He understood the prequel to sin. He understood what led a person to sin. Sins of anger, sins of violence. It starts with unresolved anger and bitterness. Genesis 4, you know the account here, Cain and Abel. They both bring a sacrifice to the Lord. Cain brings a sacrifice from his vegetable garden. Abel brings a sacrifice from his flock. He was a shepherd. A blood sacrifice. God accepts Abel's sacrifice. God does not accept Cain's sacrifice, and Cain is angry, right? Genesis 4, verse 6, then the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry, and why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. So Cain stood at a critical juncture in his life, brought about by anger, an emotionally heightened situation. And this could go one of two directions. It's the prequel to sin, right? Anger puts us in a vulnerable place. So we want to understand the prequel to sin. And certainly, David's actions here give us a context to be able to do that. And I want to suggest to you several ways that we can guard ourselves against sin by stepping back and considering how sin starts. And well, obviously, sexual sin is the case study here. These principles are transferable, whether it be sins of greed, sins of anger, sins of gluttony, whatever sin we'd want to put in that category, I think these principles are going to come to bear. So how can you guard yourself against sin? Number one, stay busy. Stay busy. The first thing we see with David is a change in his pattern. Springtime was the time when kings would go off to war in the ancient world. Kings would generally lead their troops in battle. This was certainly David's lifelong pattern. But for reasons we're not told, David decides to stay home this time. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to piece things together a little bit. David had expanded Israel's boundaries to the north and to the south and to the west and to the east. And he had basically claimed all of the land that God had given to the people of Israel. And there was a little bit of mop-up duty to still take care of. The troops were still out there squelching some little pockets of rebellion. But the real tide of the battle was not in doubt any longer. Okay, there was a sense undoubtedly of relief that was part of what was happening in David's heart. It was an ability now to take his foot off the gas just a little bit, to relax. Undoubtedly, he was a bit weary from 12 to 15 years of sustained battle, carrying out God's commands, securing peace for his people. Perhaps there was also a bit of entitlement. After all, for the last 12 or 15 years. He had sacrificed himself to a great degree, risked everything for the lives of his people. He deserved a bit of a break, right? That's easy for us to understand that type of a thought process. But it put him in a very dangerous position. This extended leisure time created an occasion for his sin. Narcissistic personality disorder. Familiar with this mental diagnosis? Narcissistic personality disorder. Mental disorder in which people have an inflated sense of their own importance. A deep need for admiration and a lack of empathy for others. They generally believe that the world revolves around them. Narcissistic personality disorder. If you've never heard of this disorder, don't worry about it, because there are many schools of psychiatric thought that are suggesting that this should be removed as a disorder because it's so normal. How do you call it a disorder when 90% of the culture embodies it? It's just norm. Parents who pamper their children, shield them from all adversity, raise self-centered children. Right? A culture that has produced narcissists. Now, I'm not suggesting by any means that David had some sort of a mental disorder, but at least for a period of time, he became very self-focused. And we see this sometimes in our kids, don't we? See it in ours. Maybe your kids are different than mine. If they've had a lot of free time, or, you know, then they get restless and discontent and get a little demanding. Why can't we do this? Can we do this? And Sharon and I'll say, yeah, that's right. We need to revisit the task list, right? Need to get their minds off themselves. Need that reminder that there's something bigger going on than just me, right? I'm not the center of the world. There's people that are hurting. You know, there's things that need to be done. There's jobs that need to be taken care of. And we found that to be helpful, to keep directing our kids' attentions off of themselves. But this is just a kid issue, right? We tend to become self-focused. Tremendous capacity for rationalization, particularly if we've enjoyed some success or we've been treated poorly, then that becomes a basis now for us, a pretext for us to sin and have a sense of entitlement. And certainly when we have a lot of free time, it can be a very dangerous thing. We get into trouble when we're looking for something to do, right? Those that are busy paddling don't have much time to argue about the color of the boat. A lot of times people who complain a lot are people who are standing on the outside with nothing to do. So we certainly see this as a principle in David's life. How would it have been different if David went out with his troops? Would he still have faced temptation? Oh, certainly. But when we engage in purposeful activity, that certainly is going to keep our mind oriented in the proper direction. So certainly as we think about the prequel of sin, we should learn to stay busy. Number two, don't make provision for sin. Don't make provision for sin. So David's milling about, nothing to do. From the roof of his palace, he observes a woman bathing. Might seem a little odd to us. What was he doing walking around on his roof? Was he this voyeuristic thing or whatever? No, that's a common cultural thing to have an upper floor, a roof, particularly in a hot Middle Eastern climate. In the cooler parts of the day, as the sun would begin to set, there'd be opportunity to catch a breeze that you wouldn't get down in the midst of the other buildings. So this was very culturally appropriate. Matter of fact, we have the sense that this woman, too, was on her roof that evening bathing, probably shielded from all of the other roofs of the same height. But the roof of the palace, of course, was a higher roof with a better vantage point, or a worse vantage point, depending on your perspective here in this text. Undoubtedly, it was an unintended glance to begin with. Nothing inherently sinful in that. But clearly David takes a second look and a third and a longer gaze, enough to register that this woman was drop-dead gorgeous. She's very beautiful, the text says. Terms that's used to describe Abraham's wife Sarah, who is turning heads at the age of 90, right? Abraham's doing all these wild things, you know, to try to keep foreigners from killing him for his 90-year-old wife. That's beauty there, okay? Now, so this is the word it's used to describe. This is not just any woman. This is an extremely attractive woman. Still, David could have stopped there, couldn't he? It would have still been sinful to gaze lustfully after this woman, but certainly the consequences would have been far different, wouldn't they? could have stopped there. But he begins to fixate on her. He plays out scenarios in his mind, sends a messenger to inquire about her. Here's the making provision for sin, beginning to make certain preparations for a potential action. Perhaps he assumed or hoped that she was unmarried, that she could be brought in as another wife in his harem. But when word came back that she was married, the switch had already been flipped. His emotions were already engaged. He had already made certain investment. Nothing, again, inherently wrong with finding out the name of this woman, but it was an action that would cause him to become dangerously entangled. We read in Proverbs, writer here talking to his son, appealing to his son in this very domain of sexual sin, says, "Can a man carry fire next to his chest and his clothes not be burned? Or can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched?" And then, very overt, Proverbs chapter 5, again speaking of the adulteress, "Keep your way far from her and do not go near the door of her house." Not only don't engage in illicit sexual involvement with her, but don't even go in proximity to her house. Don't create or make provision for sin. Wonder how many of our sins could be prevented if we embraced this principle. Went to that friend's house, even though you knew you were going to be pressured to smoke pot. Right, you made a decision to stay up surfing the internet until 2 a.m. and you wonder why you struggled with pornography. When I was in high school, my parents had what I thought were some pretty strict rules. I was never to have a girl over to our house when my parents weren't home. And I was never to be at a girl's house when her parents weren't home. And I thought it was all real restrictive. That's just a really good rule. That's legalism. No, that's wisdom. Okay? We got a lot of hang-ups with legalism. This is not legalism. This is a standard. We need to return to godly standards. Take active steps to protect ourselves from sin. Of course, now it's computers, right? We don't allow our kids to have computers or televisions or anything in their rooms, so our computers are out in the main living areas. We're just not going to create a pretext for that, okay? For what they might stumble onto, even if it's unintentionally, we just don't want to go there. You know as well as I do, now it's mobile devices, right? And it's Wi-Fi. And so we're having to constantly be revisiting this. What does this look like? We got some of our guys that are actively thinking about, you know, how we can help do some workshops and help do some training for our people. This is a huge domain, right? And we've got a little basket now. The kids have to put their things in there in the evening. There are a couple of our older kids that have iPods, and so they go in there. But how do you navigate that? How do you create or keep from making provision or setting yourself up for sin. By the way, again, it's not a kid issue, right? Number three, listen to counsel. Listen to counsel. So the messenger returns. David sends a messenger to find out who this woman is. And the messenger returns and says, her name is Bathsheba. But he goes on to say, she is the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. She is not merely, in other words, she is not merely an object for your sexual gratification, David. She is someone's daughter and she is someone's wife. More specifically, she's the wife of one of your most valued soldiers who will be listed among the mighty men at the end of 2 Samuel. Raises all sorts of red flags here for David, and yet David disregards the warning and plows through the roadblock. And if we've been paying attention, we would see that this shouldn't totally shock us. Deuteronomy 17 gives some of the guidelines for kings. This was long before there even was a king in Israel, but God said these are going to be the issues. They're not to acquire many horses, they're not to acquire many wives, they're not to acquire much wealth. And David did really good in two of those three areas, didn't he? Nailed it. Attacked the troops with all the horses, the cutting-edge military technology of the horses and chariots, and David hamstrings the horses, rendering them useless for military endeavors. And he gives all of the wealth and all of the plunder. He dedicates it to the temple of the Lord for the building of the temple. But we notice along the way that David's harem keeps increasing. When he first came to Hebron, limited rule over part of the nation. He had four wives. And then he takes his position as king in Jerusalem, and he takes additional wives and concubines. This is not a shock to us when we see this actually being played out in 2 Samuel chapter 11, that David had a blind spot. And he also, of course, had positioned himself in such a way, who was going to confront him. When you lead the team to 15 undefeated seasons, that's rarefied air, isn't it? Nobody's really wanting to make waves at that point. And so David was in a very vulnerable position. David Brainerd was a missionary to the Delaware Indians in the 18th century. This is in New Jersey area, South Jersey. Kept up an unbelievable pace in ministry. Had a very effective ministry. Many Indians came to Christ through his ministry. He was a contemporary of Jonathan Edwards, great preacher there in the Northeast, and Edwards and he were colleagues of sorts, but Edwards confronted Brainerd on a couple of occasions regarding what he felt was a blind spot in Brainerd's life. And it had to do with a sense of boundaries in terms of his health. This is how Edwards described it. He said, Brainerd was excessive in his labors, not taking due care to proportion his fatigues to his strengths. He worked too much. He didn't rest properly. He didn't take weekly Sabbath. And Edwards confronted Brainerd about this. He would ride to a village, preach throughout the day, and then through the night he would get on his horse and ride to the next village and preach the next day, and then ride on his horse by night to the next village to preach and go multiple days without sleeping. In his devotion to the Lord, right? Many admirable qualities about David Brainerd. We could learn a lot. Okay, but he had a blind spot. And on his deathbed at the age of 29, Brainerd said this. He said, God gave me a message to deliver and a horse to ride. I whipped the horse to death, and now I can't deliver the message. Brainerd, like King David, had many admirable qualities, but he had a blind spot. And how often could we avoid heartache, destructiveness of sin if we were to but listen to counsel? Do you have people in your life who will tell you the truth when you don't want to hear it? We could say, well, David's position, you know, as king really gave him a unique ability to be unaccountable. That's true in a sense. I think we have a lot of ways of remaining unaccountable. That's not a king thing, is it? In all sorts of different ways that we can keep people at arm's length, refuse to engage in confession. A lot of people, I think, don't want to be formally attached to a church. They don't want anybody in their business. That's a dangerous place to be. I have people that have approached me and had to confront me in different areas, uncomfortable, but I need that. We all need that. And so certainly we see here is this prequel to sin. And what comes beyond is David blazing through and ignoring counsel, ignoring those who warned him that what he was contemplating was wrong. Well, we're going to stop there this morning. Number four, for those notes Nazis out there, consider the consequences. Consider the consequences. Satan would have us to be focused on the moment of pleasure. And undoubtedly, it was a moment of pleasure. But Satan would have us to think about that and lose sight of the lifetime of heartache. Now, one of the purposes of Scripture is to cause us. Look at Romans 15:4. I've given you a couple texts there. You don't consider the consequences in the moment. You consider the consequences in the day-to-day. And you take note of people who lived noble lives. And you take note of people whose lives were destroyed by sin. And you learn from it. And you rehearse it. That's one of the reasons why God's given us Scripture. So consider the consequences.